Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. Welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 212, where on this week's episode of the podcast, I am going to be reviewing probably one of the most anticipated films of the year. That is Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. Now, because this is a feature film review, there will be a brief, we'll see how long, non-spoiler section as well as a full spoiler section. And then I will be responding to entertainment news of the week and listener mail and question of the week answers. All the time codes will be listed in the description should you feel the need to hop around. And I guess let's get going because we want to get home to Ithaca with Odysseus. This is the non-spoiler review for The Odyssey.
Ithaca's a kingdom waiting for a king.
My dad is coming home.
You're pining for a daddy you didn't even know.
This is very interesting review, specifically for non-spoilers on a film and TV podcast, which is The Odyssey is one of maybe the oldest stories of all time. And with that being the case, so much of it, and it's funny, I've never read The Odyssey, I've never studied The Odyssey, I am not a literature major in any regards whatsoever, but what I am aware of is its influence into pop culture as a whole. It has influenced way more things than you might be aware of, and what was particularly entertaining while watching the movie is realizing even more elements that have been interjected into the telling of The Odyssey. And then how Christopher Nolan has taken that story and adapted it in the way that only Christopher Nolan can. There are spoilers to be had if you don't know anything about The Odyssey, so I'm going to do my best to not address anything that could be conceived as a spoiler. So in the trailers, we know that Odysseus was involved with the conquering of Troy in the Trojan War. And then, you know, things went amiss and he didn't get home yet when he planned on it. And people are looking for him. There are suitors for his wife, Penelope, and his son, Telemachus, I believe is how it, there's a lot of long Greek names in this. And if I mispronounce them, apologies. I'm just going to use their actor names after I've said who they are playing. Tom Holland. And it's funny because Tom Holland has said in this movie, this is the last time he's really playing a teenager, which is hilarious because in 2 weeks he will be an adult Spider-Man in Spider-Man Brand New Day. But Telemachus, Tom Holland, it would be the king, but he's not old enough to take over the throne. And given that Ithaca is an important place, there needs to be a king because, you know, this is an ancient story where men had to be in charge of everything and women were what they were. But there is some modernization specifically within the dialogue. And that is an interesting place to sort of address, which is Christopher Nolan is a British American. And one of the choices made is through the dialogue, as well as the accents used in the film are American. Growing up with these ancient stories, and we're so accustomed to anything that is supposed to be a part of history, it's usually presented with British accents. So there's an adjustment to be made when watching this story, that they're using cadences, tone, and dialogue that you don't typically connect to this ancient Greek setting. That, for me, even though Tom Holland has said this himself, he acts normally with an American accent. It's very rare that he's used his British natural accent in things. And obviously Robert Pattinson, who is one of the suitors for Penelope, he's Batman now and quite literally in the midst of shooting The Batman Part 2. But overall, what's to say about a movie that truly now, and I've been thinking about this a lot because obviously if you're following the Film Realist on social media, I released my favorite Christopher Nolan films, the top five. Those are never what I think are the best. If you want a best of list, make sure to let me know in the comments. But those were my favorite films of his. And specifically, looking at his career as a whole, and how it's built to telling one of history's greatest tales is so perfectly suited to where he is now. The irony is, Christopher Nolan built his career working for Warner Brothers from 2002 all the way to 2020, and then had the falling out through COVID, HBO Max, and the release of Tenet, that now we get two films that really are the culmination of everything that he's made. There are elements of the Odyssey in his movies, specifically The Dark Knight Rises, which is the most funny because it's maybe the least well-received. I shouldn't say maybe. It is the least well-received film in his Dark Knight trilogy. But The Odyssey, in terms of scale and scope, budget, and the massive story in which he is trying to tell in just barely under 3 hours. This is not a small commitment of your time. And this is, I wouldn't say necessarily a criticism. There is a substantial portion of filmgoers that want their movies to be shorter. I understand and I appreciate that perspective. Gab of Movies to Watch Before You Die loves a tight 90. But with what you are trying to condense with an epic like this, this movie was always going to be this long. And whether it's a good or a bad thing is kind of besides the point. My analysis is purely on the overall experience. This is an investment, and every minute is required to tell this story, specifically because of what we have to cover in what this story is all about. There are things that you are going to be so familiar with that when they happen, it's almost more of a realization of how much this has actually impacted your love of pretty much anything within the fictitious realm of storytelling. Joseph Campbell is very heavily connected to Star Wars. There's a lot of elements that Joseph Campbell analyzed when creating what he called the hero's journey, looking at Odysseus. Matt Damon as Odysseus, this is a career-defining performance from Matt Damon. It's very funny that there are these directors who find their guys and use them in supporting roles as well as who they like using as actresses and continuing to bring them into other projects. And the opportunities that those provide to really let us see the range of these characters. If you are in your late 30s or older, you have witnessed 99% of Matt Damon's career, and the supporting nature to which he used Cillian Murphy to then win an Oscar with Oppenheimer and then do the exact same thing. I shouldn't say Oscar winner. Matt Damon will be nominated, but this is a career defining performance. Matt Damon is at the age now where telling this story of a man who truly has experienced so much just to get home. And quite literally, it is the Odyssey. Odysseus is on a journey that is so popular and famous and foretold in the world of our reality, as well as the story that will be told within the world of Odysseus. And getting to see an actor really sink his teeth into such a popular and significant role and do everything within his power for this to be arguably the definitive version of that. Because with a Christopher Nolan film and being backed by Universal, you get the opportunity to tell this story in a way that just would not be feasible now. Sword and Sandals movies, just in general, don't get made anymore. There are so few opportunities to tell movies to this scale. The irony is the only other one that will even remotely be close to this at all is from Denis Villeneuve, who is going to be completing his Dune trilogy. But between him and Christopher Nolan, they are keeping what is classic about Hollywood. Movies like Lawrence of Arabia, as well as The Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur, aren't made like they were before. There have been chances for that style of film, but Christopher Nolan, who is such a student of film history, knowing that pretty much at this point in his career he could have a blank check, decided that through all of the movies he's made that this is now the story he wants to tell. And you are getting maybe the best version of Christopher Nolan, where the intricacies in how the story is told, the performances that he is able to bring out of people, and an understanding of the tropes of this genre and how you can tell this story through his lens. I think it's very funny because, of course, when it comes to hearing dialogue, that is a famous criticism of Christopher Nolan, and whatever made him change his mind, you can hear all of the dialogue. But all of the relationships and the dynamics between each of our main characters are executed so perfectly, where this just feels, after experiencing this movie, that this is as good as it's going to get from so many of these actors. Now, Anne Hathaway is already an Oscar-winning actress. I don't believe Robert Pattinson's been nominated yet. No, but he feels like one of those actors that will get his opportunity. And getting to see a back and forth of actors who have worked together before, but Tom Holland, I'm somebody who has been critical of times of his work outside of the Spider-Man films and the Marvel films, but I've come to the belief now that it's truly come down to whatever's been on the page and whatever the directors have been asking from him. Because what Tom Holland needed to do with his performance in this film was truly establish what he is capable of as an actor outside of the Marvel machine. And there's been attempts to do this. Cherry, Uncharted, which is, you know, in there as well. The Devil All the Time. Those movies just really haven't worked to show us any of the range that Tom Holland is capable of. And what's really fascinating about this cast as a whole, I've said that too many times already, that it encompasses so many different aspects of who you would get in this kind of story. Now, calling it a blockbuster feels unfair, but when you have a budget of $250 million, you kind of would wind up being categorized like that. The intricacy and the fact that every single detail of this film matters in every aspect, not to mention, and this is a conversation that I've seen on Twitter a lot, which is the aspect ratio. This entire film was shot in IMAX, and living in Ontario, there's only really, I think, 4 theaters that offer the film in that 70 millimeter aspect ratio. Unfortunately, for the sake of this review, I wasn't able to go and see the film in IMAX. I do plan to do that, but I don't think it hindered the experience at all. You are able to enjoy and be engrossed by this film, not seeing it in the way that the director necessarily intended. I like that he's leaning into this because this adds a scale to a film that you are really only able to achieve with that specific aspect ratio. Getting it closer to natural widescreen when watching it in a regular theater doesn't detract away. I don't want people criticizing those who don't drive 10 hours to go and see this, because whatever you are able to do, and clearly this film was incredibly successful with the weekend that it had, grossing $264 million worldwide, the second biggest domestic opening of the weekend. This is proof that the testament of the filmmaker, the quality of his work, as well as everybody who's involved with this film. You have established Hollywood talent that are in the veteran class with Matt Damon, Charlize Theron. You have, I mean, an older millennial, and Robert Pattinson's going to hate that, but Lupita Nyong'o. And then you've got John Leguizamo, John Bernthal, Hamish Patel. Everyone fits so perfectly into their roles. Elliot Page, Bill Irwin. There's a lot of actors in this that are touchstones of Christopher Nolan's career. Obviously, Matt Damon and Anne Hathaway have been in his other films, but bringing in some of the younger crop to fill out this world to also draw people in. You can't just be populating it with people that everybody are familiar with just for the sake of it. You need to be casting them in roles that really feel like they fit the actor. That's the job of the casting director, as well as the actual director of the film, to make sure that everything can be executed the way that he would want it to be done. I'm specifically talking about Christopher Nolan. And the journey that Odysseus goes on has quite literally its ups and downs, and is so baked into the Greek mythology that so much of it just feels like a warm reminder of what makes a classic story work because of the expectations that you have growing up with them. The foundation of how this story is told should feel very familiar. And that is a good thing because it allows what Christopher Nolan has changed purely for aesthetic or the aspect ratio or the way that the performances are delivered. And not to say that any of them are done in a way that feels sort of outside of what you would get. It took me a minute for the accents, as I mentioned, but getting to see a classic through Christopher Nolan's lens, only done in the way that he could. There are filmmakers that could make The Odyssey, but Christopher Nolan has such a specificity to how he makes his movies, to the talent he brings into them, to the use of visual effects, to a world that so feels so incredibly tangible, where everything feels as if it is lived in, and blending genre in a way that just makes you curious for what he's going to do moving forward, and aspects of all of the different movies he's made and how that's created the filmmaker that he is now, and how he could use those techniques to make this movie. I don't think anyone going into a Christopher Nolan movie of nearly 3 hours, clearly a lot of people went and saw Oppenheimer, which was 3 hours, which nearly made $1 billion, but an R-rated swords and sandals movie with a lot of American actors and a lot of other talent from a lot of other places, but an American accented Odyssey, it delivers on everything you would expect. This is Christopher Nolan, maybe not at the height of his powers because we're just in a different era than we were, say, when The Dark Knight came out, but specifically with filmgoers now, there's a lot of expectation to justify what would drive people to go to the theater. And it's proven that with the right filmmaker, the right story, the right cast, and I would be completely ignorant without mentioning it, the right marketing behind it, this is a story quite literally as old as time, and it drove people to the theater. And as a result, it's one of Christopher Nolan's best films. I don't know if it is his best film. I've seen all of his other films substantially more, but it is an achievement that so few could have done, and a testament to everyone working on it. It's spectacular, and it's worth the time. Like, it's hard to tell somebody that 3 hours is worth their time a lot, but this is. So that will do it for non-spoilers. I know it's hard, and there was a lot of talk about around the movie as well as what was in it, but we get into spoilers now and really dive into Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. Spoilers are coming. You have been warned.
No one could stand between me and home. Not even the gods.
The first place that I want to start that almost made me chuckle is we see all of the suitors inside of the palace in Ithaca, and Penelope is there, and there is someone who is telling the story of Odysseus and where he went and what he accomplished and the Trojan War and its conclusion are an incredibly important story. Getting to hear about the recruitment of all of the Ithacans and the Greeks and what was done for some of them to not have to serve, one of those being Robert Pattinson, whose farmhand went instead of him, who is Sinon, played by Elliot Page, who is perfect in this role. I think it's really awesome that Christopher Nolan took Elliot Page, who of course everyone would know from Inception, and put him in such a different kind of role, which I said this in non-spoilers, but it lets the actors really stretch themselves, and it's not that they're having a hard time with these performances. They're allowed to lean into something fresh, and it makes those characters feel even more real because those are not trite and things we've seen before that sort of just feel like actors are spinning their wheels. They have to sink their teeth into these roles to make all of this feel believable and to get the audience to buy into the relationships between the characters. Everything has to have that level of precision to really work. I laughed because when we see the story being laid out of Odysseus, it is revealed by the end of the movie that that is in fact something that was happening much later, which is very funny to me. Of course, in The Odyssey, Christopher Nolan is going to be jumping back and forth in time. He loves telling a story in a non-linear way. Now, if you were a literature analysis professional studier of this art form, I don't know if this is how the story is laid out. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but regardless of that, I do think it's funny that someone known for telling his stories that way continues to do so with his version of the Odyssey. But that does really help establish kind of what the stakes are for Odysseus. He's gone off to serve Agamemnon, who is played by, I'm forgetting everyone in this movie now because there's it's quite a big cast. Where are you, Agamemnon? Oh, it's Benny Safdie, duh. And we see what led to the Trojan horse being made and everything that led to that plan, the commitment of 10 years on the beaches of Troy before actually taking the city. But it's a much more personal story than just achieving victory in a war. For Odysseus, his wife Penelope is being pressured into finding a new suitor so that there can be a king of Ithaca. And Tom Holland, who's Matt Damon's son, I said this in non-spoilers, he's not a full-grown man yet, even though he's like 28 maybe when this movie shot. But you know, Tom, it looks incredibly young, and he used it to his opportunity to be in a Christopher Nolan film. But Odysseus has not returned for nearly 20 years. Telemachus, who is Tom Holland's character, is really concerned for his mother, as well as what is going to happen to his home. All of the suitors are eating all of their food. John Leguizamo, who is the blind pig farmer, is very much hoping that Odysseus returns. But Odysseus, he's been living a crazy, crazy life. The journey home is the part of the story that most people would probably be familiar with. We saw in the trailers the Cyclops. We see the giants and truly being tested by the Greek gods for not following Zeus's law. There was an emphasis on breaking Zeus's law and what that does to humanity. And Christopher Nolan, other filmmakers would probably be doing this, but Christopher Nolan is a director who doesn't really necessarily lean into politics, but you can understand his perspective on the story he's telling and the morality within the story based on what happens to our characters. There's a repeated line about breaking the law of Zeus and the consequences for doing so lead to the mission of Odysseus trying to return home. What's so funny narratively, as much as we get to see someone telling the story of Odysseus to the suitors, we also get John Bernthal's character telling the story of the Trojan horse to Tom Holland. He's maybe the most American actor in this movie, where it really just felt like Christopher Nolan wanted John Bernthal. I like John Bernthal, and you just put him into this world and he's going to be John Bernthal, and it works for the role that is asked of him in the movie. So you get a character telling a story to then have another character telling another story. But guess what? There's a third layer to this onion, because Odysseus, who's been trapped with, I believe it's Calliope. No, it's a different Greek name. Calypso is trapped and is telling her the memories of where he was, because he has forgotten them due to the trauma that he's experienced on the mission that led him to where he is. And the visuals of this are so interesting, because as much as this is developed as a real world and something that could be very applicable to a lot of individuals, not having to really stretch the imagination just in terms of the fantastical and mythological elements, we don't see any of the gods. We do see the sirens, but much of it is just baked into the elements being the representation of the gods. We have the sea, we have Zeus with lightning and thunder and storms, and how they are targeting Odysseus and his crew because of the things that they've done. And all of the visualizations of that just add an element of tension, because it feels much more baked into the real world. You are on the edge of your seat, hoping that they overcome all of these experiences, because it's such a personal story. There's a grandeur to everything about this, but at the end of the day, it's Odysseus just trying to get home to his wife and child, who he barely even knows. And getting to see what is, to me, what was so funny, and I mentioned this in non-spoilers, so much of this, and yes, There are elements of The Dark Knight Returns in The Dark Knight Rises, but even more so than that, because Christopher Nolan is a fan of the classics, a good chunk of The Dark Knight Rises is just the Odyssey, the way that Bruce Wayne is tested with the trials, the return, pretending to not be himself. And that's really when the movie sort of settled into me about the mythos behind who Odysseus is and this legend that has grown over the 20 years, who this man is. Could he truly live up to what everyone's expectations of him are? And that the conflict he's facing is getting rid of all these suitors. There are laws. People are welcomed into your home and you can do them no harm because you would be exiled for breaking these laws because they're still trying to hold these things up. There are people amongst the world who are breaking these laws, creating chaos. And this is something that Odysseus and Penelope don't want, specifically for their son, Tom Holland. And getting to feel connected to what is, at the end of the day, a story about three people. There are much more characters to this story, but your investment is in those three people, and you want the father to get home to his family at the end of the day. You can have a movie on this scale and this scope, but if you get lost in what the point of the story is, the movie doesn't work, and it does because of Matt Damon, Tom Holland, and Anne Hathaway. Robert Pattinson, he's really good at being a bad guy. He's also a great Batman. But to just see a conniving, manipulative character who is doing whatever he can to achieve at the end of the day for him, becoming the suitor and the new husband for Anne Hathaway's Penelope, his antagonistic behavior towards Tom Holland and the back and forth that he has with Corey Hawkins, it just works so well in establishing the underbelly of all of what these guys are trying to achieve. And there's a sequence in this movie that made me laugh because I don't know where, if it was the chicken or the egg. And what I mean with that is there's a moment in this because Odysseus returns home, and in order to free his wife from all these suitors, he has to pretend he's not himself. So he's got a robe, or I guess it's like rags, but he's got a hood over himself and he's pretending to be Sinon, who is Elliot Page's character, the farmhand who volunteered so that way Robert Pattinson didn't have to go off and fight in the war. And after going to hell to visit Hades, Matt Damon promises that he'll return the little stick that Sinon took to serve in the army to win the Trojan War. And Odysseus, pretending to not be himself, has returned to Ithaca and sees somebody who knows that it's him. And he just sort of smiles and asks them without saying anything to not reveal who he is. And it just reminded me of The Mask of Zorro, which has two sequences like that, where Anthony Hopkins does it in the very beginning, and then Antonio Banderas does it when he's in the jail cells of the gold mine at the end of the movie. I don't know where this sequence is from, because The Odyssey is a poem. It didn't have any pictures. At some point, there's obviously probably visualizations of what this story is, of a character pretending to not be themselves, but it made me laugh because The Mask of Zorro is one of my favorite. It's not technically a sword and sandals movie, but it's a swashbuckling film. And the politics of this world are just as important as is the mythos behind all of the gods. So many of the characters are concerned with the aftermath of slighting a god, but to a certain point. And I like to see how that works specifically with Odysseus, who does challenge what the laws are of them and his belief in what the consequences of those choices are going to be. But for him, he is still this general trying to do his best to get his men home. It's not necessarily just about him. It is also about getting his crew home. And the sequence with Circe the witch and the pigs are horror that we've not seen from Christopher Nolan before. There's been a huge sentiment after the film came out that a lot of people would like to see that from him. But having a film like this that has sequences that really lean into different subgenres of filmmaking get to stretch Christopher Nolan's skills in ways we haven't necessarily seen before. And I said this in non-spoilers, it's really true that all of the movies he's made have built him to tell this story. Obviously, Oppenheimer focus specifically on Oppenheimer and the creation of the bomb and what that did to J. Robert Oppenheimer's life. But the character focus in this, yes, it's the Odyssey, but it is on Odysseus. And if that doesn't work specifically heralding the main character and his story, this movie falls apart. And I can already hear what some listeners are probably saying. Well, obviously, you have to have a main character in your film, Kyle. That is true. But I really feel like this is everything that Christopher Nolan has been building to deliver this movie. It was so funny before the film came out and before it was even announced what Christopher Nolan's next movie was going to be. And we really had no idea. And when it finally was revealed to be The Odyssey, there were so many questions as to how he was going to do a lot of these sequences. And he delivers them in the Christopher Nolan way you would expect. I find it so... I can't stop laughing internally. Coming off of Moana, and one of the criticisms was, I don't know how often they were actually on a boat. And how refreshing and rewarding it was to see so many boats on actual water and getting the, it's not even grandeur, but just getting to see real stuff and understanding that you have to have this feel like the world is lived in. More so than anything else, these classics are so important and they've been so established and the foundation for so many other stories that the delivery has to be on the highest level possible. And that is the case with this movie, from the direction, from the script, ironically, both from Christopher Nolan, from the entire cast, the cinematography from Hoyt Van Hoytema, awesome. He's coming off of so many films with Christopher Nolan, but from Interstellar onward, really knowing how to make this movie look the best way possible in IMAX aspect ratio film only. But the music from Ludwig Göransson, that sounds unlike any of the scores he's ever done before. I think it's really funny. I've said that a bunch too. But I'm watching Community with my wife. She's never seen it for the first time. And knowing that this guy would go on to win, I believe it's... Does he have 3 Oscars already? How many does he have? I should know that off the top of my head, but I don't remember how many you have. I want to say it's at least 2. No, it is 3. I was right the first time. I was having to pull that up on Wikipedia. I loved The Odyssey. It is a commitment. It is a movie that will entrench you in this world. I don't know if anybody could do this. Denis Villeneuve makes a very different kind of movie when he's making his Dune trilogy. And they're reminiscent of classics. But Christopher Nolan is clearly a student of them and delivers a movie on a scale unlike anything we've seen in a very long time, in a classic world that takes his liberties to deliver the story the best way that he knows how. And he does that from start to finish. I loved this movie. Is it my favorite Christopher Nolan film? Probably not, just because it's of a character that's not my favorite. I love me some Batman. He's my favorite character in fictional story history. But each of the moments in the story that we get with things we're familiar with, the Cyclops sequence is another element of really leaning into the scale, but also telling it in a new and interesting way in the genre. There's a painting apparently that inspired Christopher Nolan. I shouldn't say Chris, his name, he's a Christopher, and how he wanted to tell that sequence. And it looks unlike any other way we've seen that before. There's so much more of it that usually feels larger than life. And all of the use of visual effects in this, it's going to get nominated for that as well, because whether it's integration of somebody who is just very tall in makeup and then rotoscoped into the film, it's seamless. Any enhancement of the environment is that way. It's not going for the everything has to be CGI. And that's one of those benefits that I think so many people who have chosen to not go to the theater are going to appreciate about this movie. It's not 25 minutes of CGI where maybe the voices of the actors are actually being used, but they're clearly standing in a studio recording their lines just at a microphone. the Trojan War and the brutality and the realization of what they've done, and Odysseus and his interpersonal expectations of himself and his own history, and the evaluation of all those things, and where he is at the end of the movie, willing to sacrifice his reputation and go into exile with his wife, the thing she wanted him to do before he went to the Trojan War, delivers a satisfying ending and a conclusion to the story where their little boy, Tom Holland, who's really a man now, gets to be king. It's just, it's a gratifying expectation to have such high anticipation for one of the best filmmakers going. And this is maybe the thesis statement that he is the best filmmaker of the 21st century. There's going to be a lot of debate about that, and I love to have one because there's a French Canadian who's also a huge part of that conversation, Denis Villeneuve, and will continue to be until Dune Part 3 comes out in December. That will do it for my full spoiler review of The Odyssey. Did you see it in IMAX? Did you see it regular? What did you think of the film? Make sure to let me know in the comments. And now let's get to the entertainment news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom!
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
I teased this a little bit, I believe, in non-spoilers, which is The Batman is being delayed, part two, until 2028. I love The Batman Part 1. It might be my favorite live-action Batman film. I, of course, announced on the podcast that I love Batman Begins, and I do love Batman Begins more than The Dark Knight. That might be controversial. My favorite Batman movie is animated, but I'm not going to reveal that here because it might be related to a question of the week from a listener, actually, so I'm going to save that for later, but what's so frustrating is there's been so many real-world hurdles that have prevented The Batman Part 2 from being delivered when it was originally planned at least 3 years ago. The Batman Part 1 came out in 2022, and that was obviously affected by COVID and many, many delays. A four-year release, which would have been completely reasonable, would have been by now. And I know that we had the Penguin television series to hold us over, and the Penguin television series was absolutely incredible. But the fact that it's going to be 4 years removed from that series, I saw this tweet and it made me laugh, which is Robert Pattinson is going to be 42 when The Batman Part 2 comes out, which is how old Ben Affleck was as an old grizzled Batman in Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. Now, I think they look different. Matt Reeves is one of my favorite writers and directors, and I know and I believe and I feel, I have faith that it is going to be a spectacular film. I'm willing to bet it's going to be better than The Batman. I really am, because establishing and introducing your own Batman, that part's hard. And maybe the hardest part of that job, but getting to tell a sequel with something he's had 5 years pretty much to work on, is there's going to be even more expectation, because even though The Batman was successful, all of the hype behind it and every delay. I do not subscribe to the fan theory that this means Robert Pattinson is going to get pulled into the DCU. I think, given how long these films have taken, it's going to prevent that even more so. And there's been rumors as to who may be playing Batman in Brave and the Bold and in a cameo in Clayface. And until we know who that is, I don't really want to speculate on that. But I am incredibly disappointed because I love The Batman and I really wanted to see this movie next year. And I am one of the people that will say, let it take as long as it needs to. Across the Spider-Verse took 5 years and it's going to be four. I now can't remember. Beyond the Spider-Verse, I want to say is four years. 4 years removed from Across the Spider-Verse, and I think that's going to be regarded as one of the greatest film trilogies of all time. So let them cook. I know that I may be too old to be saying that, but that's how I feel. God of War replacing its lead actor truly does suck. You go through the tedious work of trying to capture this in live action, and Ryan Hurst, I thought, was going to do a really great job. I thought he was awesome in The Odyssey. I didn't mention him because he plays a supporting role. It's substantial, but this guy clearly cared so much, and it's been revealed they shot 4 episodes already. I am not a longtime fan of the God of War franchise. I played the God of War, I believe it was 2018, and I played Ragnarok, and I really loved those games. It's a great world, and it's funny talking about this because of the mythology in The Odyssey, but the way that they weave all of those stories together, tell something new and original, the irony is not lost on me, but about a father and a son, and its bridge into North mythology. I can't say that word today. Mythology, my goodness. I feel really bad for Ryan Hurst, because clearly he was the guy to be Kratos, and now he's not going to be, and he's going to be replaced with somebody else at this current time. We have no idea who that's going to be, but I really feel for the actor, and clearly this shows that Prime wants to get this right. It does suck that it sounds like it was going to take a really long time for him to recover, which is why it's being recast, but man, that's really unfortunate, and I was looking forward to that show. Prime has a lot of really excellent television series. I love their animated stuff, but there's a lot of their live action shows that really work. Obviously, The Boys, Reacher as an example. But yeah, it's disappointing, and this is going to delay because they're going to have to reshoot the other 4 episodes. And I hope they just reshoot the entire episode and just don't cycle in somebody with a green screen replacement, because that'll be really annoying. And Prime Video, I do think you're better than that. And then the last thing connected to last week's review, Colman Domingo is working on a Tiana movie, who is the lead in Princess and the Frog. Princess and the Frog is, I believe, a truly underrated Disney film. It is the last, really, of their animated films before we got the CGI renaissance with what we got later on. And it's got great music. It was directed by John Musker and Ron Clements, who went on to direct Moana. But what they've done with their filmography is truly impressive. Tiana is an iconic Disney princess. There's a phenomenal soundtrack, which most of the time, as removed from the film, becomes even more popular than the actual film itself. There's a reason something like Frozen, and even though I love Tangled, didn't reach the heights, probably because of the soundtrack. I love 2D animation. This is a franchise that sort of, it's not even a franchise, it's one film that sort of just sits in this weird spot. It is 17 years old at this point already, which is just, it's baffling to me that that's the case, but it is. So if there's an avenue in which you can tell this story in a new way, I'm up for that, because it hasn't been dredged through like a lot of these other films, and it has been a while. This is a weird era for Disney, choosing to then go into CGI, which clearly they're already doing with Moana. Tangled is already getting a live-action remake, so I'm okay with this. I love me some Colman Domingo, and I'm very curious on what his perspective into the Princess and the Frog story is going to be. I'm on board. Not necessarily for every live-action remake, but for this one, I am. Probably briefer than you expected, but that's really it for news of the week. If I miss something, let me know, tag me in it, or email me, filmreelistpod@gmail.com, and I'll make sure to check it out and add it to the notes for next week's episode. But now, let's get to Question of the Week and Listener Mail.
Can I ask you a question?
Just fun?
There's something I've been meaning to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what was the first Christopher Nolan movie you saw? KCA said Memento. Jason Alesso Marin Tindock said Batman Begins / The Prestige back to back. Miss Cat Member said Memento was first, then The Following. Poochie says Insomnia. Memo Cactus Inception. Simon Gibbs says Memento. And then on Anchor/Spotify, it's all the same thing at the end of the day. We have Scotty Cameron writing in, the first movie I saw was Batman Begins. It was 2005, and my love for Spider-Man throughout 2004 had wore off. Batman started becoming my new obsession. To make a Toy Story analogy, my Spider-Man action figure was Woody. Saw the arrival of my Batman action figure, Buzz, and my bedding and posters went from Spider-Man to Batman. Granted, I didn't actually see Batman Begins until Christmas when my parents got it from Blockbuster. That's a dated reference, Scotty. I watched The Batman on Saturdays as well. And then Dylan writes in, first Nolan movie I saw was definitely Memento. I haven't watched it in years, but I always like it because Guy Pearce shows up in it. Yeah, it's funny. I would be shocked if for most people it wasn't Batman Begins, because that really blew up in ways that I don't think many people who are diehard fans were expecting. Faust5398 on YouTube says The Prestige, but Insomnia right after. Cinema Spool says The Dark Knight. Sest Finished says Inception. And then CalNorman89 says Insomnia. He's made so many films, and if you were just somebody who went to the theater all the time, you probably would have seen movies from him, maybe without even knowing they were Christopher Nolan films, because back then they weren't just Christopher Nolan films. And then we have a question here from Jermaine Jones, who says, what are my top five Batman favorites? Now, this is really complicated, Jermaine, just specifically because I am a child of the 90s, and the best Batman of all time is Kevin Conroy. He actually did get to play him in live action. But in terms of just defining Batman for a generation, Kevin Conroy did that, maybe even two generations, given the length of his time in the role, which also then went into the video games with the Arkham series. But my favorite Batman movie, and this might be controversial, is actually Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker. The place that that film sits in the continuity, establishing the demise and the end of the Joker, as well as truly defining Terry McGinnis as his own Batman, having to go toe-to-toe with the Clown Prince of Crime, that for me is as great as it gets. TMS, and I was a sucker for Batman Beyond. It hit me exactly when I needed it to, and pun intended, its exploration of just the mythos of what it means to be Batman and Bruce's relationship with Terry, it's perfect. And as sort of a series finale until stuff came out later down the line, that's my favorite Batman movie, followed by Batman Mask of Phantasm. I did a review on Phantasm in the 4K with Brian Manili from Jump on the Batwagon, so that would be my second favorite. My third favorite is The Batman. I talked about why I loved it. It's awesome. I did a re-review of when around Halloween, and I just really love a Batman movie that's actually about Batman, which connects to my number four, which is Batman Begins. Nolan redefined Batman in that generation, truly establishing a new gritty take on Batman that a lot of other superheroes tried to recreate, and you just never did. And number five would be The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight, and I said this in my Nolan thing, is the best movie that has Batman in it. I wish Nolan took his love of character and leading character and just shifted that movie slightly a bit. It is impossible to ignore what that movie is and the level of execution of everything involved with it. Heath Ledger's Joker. It's just not my favorite, and that's why it would be number five. All those choices might upset some people. So if you have your idea of what your five favorite Batman films are, let me know, because I would be very excited to see them. Well, that will do it for all of our mail and our question of the week answers. And that connects to the question of the week for next week. Now, there's a caveat here. If you would like me to see your question of the week answer, it needs to be submitted by Tuesday. So if you're listening to this of day of release, needs to be submitted by Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So that would be July 21st. I am going on vacation, but I will have the episode pre-recorded and scheduled to be uploaded at the regular time. That review will be of an upcoming movie, and you might be able to guess what it is just based on the question of the week, which is, if you could pick one of the four elements, what bender would you be? Would you be an airbender, a waterbender, a firebender, or an earthbender? To answer the question of the week, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com, or you can answer directly on YouTube and Spotify, or at the Film Realist on any of the social medias. Just make sure to include the hashtag QOTW. If you are watching the podcast on YouTube, please like and subscribe. It helps the channel grow and gets into more people's algorithms. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this was your own Odyssey podcast. My name is Kyle Naranja, and I will see you next time.